You're listening to Big Ideas, the only regularly scheduled television program in North America devoted to the art of the lecture and the importance of ideas in public life. It is broadcast on TVO every Saturday and Sunday at 4 p.m. For more information on our program, go to our website at tvo.org/bigideas.
In every century, philosophers and artists have supplied definitions of beauty and thanks to their work. It is possible to reconstruct the history of aesthetic ideas over time. But this didn't happen with ugliness. Most of the time it was defined as the opposite of beauty. But almost no one ever devoted a treatise of any length to ugliness, which was relegated to passing mentions in marginal works. And the first serious study was 1853, The Aesthetics of Ugliness of Karl Rosenkranz. Hence, while the history of beauty can draw on a wide range of theoretical sources from which we can deduce the tastes of a given epoch, for the most part, the history of ugliness must seek out its own document in the visual or verbal portrayals of things or people that were in some way seen as ugly. Well, I won't deal with ugliness because in doing both books I discovered that to assemble materials for a history of ugliness is funnier than to make a history of beauty, because beauty is in some way boring. Even if its concept changes through the ages, nevertheless, a beautiful object must always follow certain rules. So to speak, a beautiful nose shouldn't be no longer or shorter than a given measure. On the contrary, an ugly nose can be as long as the one of Pinocchio, as big as the trunk of an elephant, or like the beak of an eagle, and so on. Ugliness is unpredictable and offers an infinite range of possibilities. Nonetheless, the history of ugliness shares some common characteristics with the history of beauty. First, for the past centuries, the only documents we have are artworks. We can only assume that the tastes of ordinary people corresponded in some way with the tastes of the artists of their day. If a visitor from the space went into a gallery of contemporary art, and if he saw that woman painted by Picasso and heard onlookers describing this painting as beautiful, he might get the mistaken idea that in everyday life, men of our time find female creatures with faces like that beautiful and desirable. But our visitor from space might modify his opinion on watching a fashion show in which he would witness the celebration of other models of beauty. Second, both for beauty and ugliness, we can only speak of our Western culture. For an exotic culture, we don't have theoretical text to tell us if that mask were intended to cause aesthetic delight, holy fear, or hilarity. Conversely, believers in some non-European religion might be disgusted by an image of Christ scourged, bleeding, and humiliated, while this apparent corporeal ugliness arouses feeling of sympathy and tenderness in a Christian. Concepts of beauty and ugliness are relative to various historical periods and various cultures, and to quote Voltaire, ask a toad what beauty is, true beauty, the toque alone, he will tell you that it consists on his mate with her two fine round eyes protruding for her small head, her broad flat throat, her yellow belly and brown back. Ask the devil, he will tell you that beauty is a pair of horn, four claws and a tail. Attributions of beauty over ugliness are often due to non-aesthetic but socio-political criterion. Marx pointed out how the possession of money may compensate for ugliness. I am ugly, but I can buy myself the most beautiful of women. Hence, I am not ugly. I am lame, but money gives me 24 legs. Now, if we extend this observation on money to power in general, we can understand a certain portrait of monarchs of century past who were no doubt very ugly, but their omnipotence lent them such charisma and glamour that their subjects saw them through adoring eyes. Let's read Friedrich Brown's Sentinel, one of the finest short stories produced by contemporary science fiction. It's a long quotation. "He was soaked to the skin and up to the eyes in mud, and I was hungry, and he was hungry and cold, and was 50,000 light years far from home. A foreign sun emitted an icy bluish tide, and the gravity, double what he was used to, made the slightest movement weary and painful. The enemy, the only other intelligent race in the galaxy, cruel, repulsive, hideous creatures, horrible monsters. Then he saw one of them creeping towards him. He aimed his weapon and opened fire on it. The enemy gave that strange, horrible cry that all of them used to utter. Then a deathly silence. It was dead. The cry and the sight of the dead body made him shudder. In the course of time, many of them had become accustomed, took no notice of that, but not he. They were horrible, disgusting creatures with only two legs, two arms, two eyes, that sickening white skin and without scales." So, while reading, we are thinking of a monster like that, and on the contrary, the protagonist was seeing something similar to death. Karl Rosenkrantz, in his History of Ugliness, draws an analogy between ugliness and moral evil. Just as evil and sin are the opposite of good, whose hell they represent, so is ugliness the hell of beauty. As these, and I show you some nice experiments of uglification I found on internet without the name of the author. Look. But the same Rosenkrantz reverts to the traditional notion of ugliness as the opposite of beauty by analyzing various incarnations of ugliness. Ugliness in nature, spiritual ugliness, ugliness in art, like absence of form, asymmetry, disharmony, disfigurement, deformation. Besides, we examine the synonyms of ugly, we find the repellent, horrible, horrendous, disgusting, disagreeable, grotesque, abominable, repulsive, odious, indecent, fool, dirty, obscene, repugnant, frightening, abject, monstrous, horrid, horrifying, unpleasant, terrible, terrifying, frightful, nightmarish, revolting, sickening, fitted, fearsome, ignoble, ungainly, displeasing, tiresome, offensive, deformed, disfigured, and so on. In general, look in your dictionary. It seems that the experience of beauty arouses what Kant, in his Critique of Judgment, defined as disinterested pleasure, whereas we would like to have all that seems agreeable to us, or to take part in all that seems good. The judgment of taste at the sight of a flower procures a pleasure that excludes any desire for possession or consumption. Hence, certain philosophers have wondered whether it is possible to make an aesthetic judgment of ugliness, given that ugliness arouses emotional reactions, such as disgust and repulsion. As a matter of fact, we ought to distinguish between manifestations of ugliness in itself, excrements decomposing carrion, someone covered with sores, we give off a nauseating stench, or, no, this animal, which 2 years ago won the contest for the ugliest dog in the world. And we have to distinguish those manifestations of ugliness in itself from those of formal ugliness, understood as a lack of equilibrium in the organic relationship between the parts and the whole. Besides, this beautiful painting by Ghirlandaio suggests that, as the tender attitude of the grandchild shows, a person, an animal or else, can be ugly and at the same time nice and lovable. However, this portrait was the portrait of Ghirlandaio was an example of beautiful artistic representation of ugliness. Now, let's see, on the contrary, two examples of ugly artistic representation of something that was supposed to be beautiful. Incidentally, the author of both paintings was Adolf Hitler, and the fact that he decided later to shift to politics has been certainly a disaster for the history of the world, but an happy event for the history of art. The Greek identified the beautiful with the good, kalos, kai, agathos, and by consequent, the ugly with the evil. See, for instance, the description of Thersites in Homer. Thersites was the ugliest man that stood before Ilium, bandy legs and lame in one foot. He had round shoulders hunched over his chest. He had a pointed head and sparse thin hair. Achilles and Ulysses hated him the most, for he often insulted them. But at the same time, the Greek knew that Socrates was as ugly as a Silenus, but had a great soul, or that Aesop was, according to the legend, repugnant to the sight, disgusting, fat belly, bulging head, pug nose, gibbous, swart in short, with flat feet, short arms, bendy legs, thick lips, stammered, and was quite unable to express himself. And in spite of this, he was defined as a benefactor of the humanity. We idealize the Greek culture as mainly focused around beauty and harmony, but we frequently forget that the Greek world was also populated by terrifying creatures, hybrids that violate the laws of natural forms, like the harpies or the sirens. We were not the attractive women with the tail of a fish as described by the later tradition, but nasty, rapacious birds. And there was Priapus, who was considered ridiculous because of that huge member and was not thought to be handsome and was defined as amorphos, ugly, aischon, because his was not the correct form. He was oppressed by loneliness, his incapacity to seduce a nymph despite his hypertrophic possibilities. Even though in the history of literature is full of descriptions of ugly men, the vituperatio with regard to women, whose ugliness reveals their inner malice and pernicious power of seduction, was a theme that enjoyed great success. It happened so in classical literature, and Horace, Catullus, and Martial had already provided us with repulsive portraits of women. In the early Christian literature, the problem of cosmetics cropped up with Tertullian, who remarks with ruthless severity that, according to the scriptures, the allurement of beauty are always as one with the prostitution of the body. Apart from the moral condemnation, Tertullian is insinuating that women plaster themselves with makeup and other artifices to conceal their physical defects. In the Middle Ages, there were many portrayals of old woman, a symbol of physical and moral decay, and the acme of misogyny was reached in Boccaccio's Corbaccio. The narrator loves unrequited a beautiful widow, and his evident resentment is expressed by the soul of her husband that ascends from purgatory to tell about the licentiousness and the perfidy of this woman, revealing that she conceals her 50 years with creams and other revolting muck, and dwelling at length upon the disgusting details of her physical ugliness. During the Renaissance, look at Leonardo, female ugliness became the subject of lampoons containing ironic praise of models that didn't conform to the dominant aesthetic canon. And let me only quote these nice verses of Clément Marot on two ugly tits. First in French, because it's so beautiful, tétin qui n'a rien que la peau, tétin flac, tétin de drapeau, grand tétin, longue tétasse, tétin, dois-je dire, bézasse. Tétin au grand vilain bout noir, comme celui d'un entonnoir. Tétin qui brimballe à tout coup, sans être esbranlé, ne secoue. Tétin grillé, tétin pendant, tétin flestri, tétin rendant, vilaine bourbe au lieu de lait. Teeth, that is nothing but skin. Scrawny flag, limply flapping big teeth, long teeth, squashed teeth, teeth like a bun, teeth with a pointy nipple, like the sharp end of a funnel. You jounce about at every move without any need for a shake. Toast teeth, hanging teeth, wrinkled teeth, teeth that gives mud instead of milk. The devil wants you in his infernal family to nurse his daughter. Teeth to be thrown over one shoulders, and so on and so, and so forth. Later in the Baroque period, a woman's imperfections were described as elements of interest, sometimes as a sensual stimuli. Poems appeared in praise of women who stammered, or were dwarfs, hunchbacks, cross-eyed, pockmarked, and in contrast to the medieval tradition of highly colored or rosy cheeks, Giovan Battista Marino extolled the pallor of his beloved. Pallidette. Tutto mio sole, ai tuoi dolci pallori, perde l'alba vermiglia i suoi colori. Pallidetta mia morte, alle tue dolci e pallide viole, la porpora amorosa perde, vinta la rosa. Oh, piaccia la mia sorte, che dolce teco impallidisca anch'io, pallidetto amor mio. Oh, one little son of mine. The bright red dawn loses its colors before your sweet pallor. Oh, dear pallid death of my vanquished, the rose loses its red, amorous color before your sweet and pallid violets. Oh, let it please destiny that I might become as pallid as you, my sweet love. Probably the most grotesque celebration of the female ugliness is to be found in The Anatomy of Melancholy by Burton. Love is blind, as the saying is, Cupid's blind, and so are all his followers. Quisquit amat ranam, ranam putat esse dianam. Every lover admires his mistress, though she be very deformed of herself, ill-favored, wrinkled, pimple-pale, red-yellow tanned, tallow-faced, have a swollen juggler's platter face, or a thin, link chitty face, have clouds in her face, be crooked, dry, bald, google-eyed, blear-eyed, or with staring eyes, she looks like a squid's cat, hollow-eyed, black or yellow about the eyes, or squint-eyed, sparrow-mouthed, Persian hook-nosed, have a sharp fox nose, a red nose, China flat, Greek nose, a nose like a promontory, rotten teeth, black, uneven, brown teeth, beetle-browed, a witch's beard, her breath stinks all over the room, her nose drop winter and summer, with a Bavarian poke under her chin, a sharp chin, lovingly appeared with a long crane's neck. Her dogs like to double jack, so else no dogs. In that other extreme, bloody fallen fingers, he have filthy long and pale nails, scabbed hands or wrist, a tanned skin, a rotten carcass, crooked back, she stoops, his limbs play-footed, as slender in the middle as a cow in the waist, gouty legs, her ankles hang over, he has shoes, her feet stink, she breathes, lies, a mere changeling, a very monster, a slut, a scold, a nasty, rank, filthy, beastly queen, dishonest, peradventure, obscene, base, beggarly, rude, foolish, and tough, peevish. If the love her once, he admires her for all this, he takes no notice of any such errors or imperfections of body or mind. He had rather have her than any woman in the world. As for the male ugliness, as Hegel pointed out in his Aesthetics, when the Christian art had to deal with the passion of Christ, he couldn't not use the former Greek beauty to portray Christ scourged, crowned with thorn, dying on the cross. Hegel had also observed that with the same contexts, ugliness is also a typical feature of the persecutors of Christ. Since in the Christian world the sanctity is none other than an imitation of Christ, atrocious suffering was the lot of martyrs and of saints, appearing in all the splendor of their body made ugly by penitence. If saints had to be ugly but lovable, for the Middle Ages even monsters were not always terrifying beings like the monsters of the Apocalypse, or malignant being like dragoons. There were amiable monsters too, who populated bestiaries and the books of Mirabilia, gentle creatures whose form and habits were certainly extraordinary and equally far removed from every human idol of beauty or fitness, but who were considered as bearers of symbolical and moral sense. Such were, for instance, the Panotti, the Cynocephali, the Schiapods, the Blemmi, and the most beautiful among the monsters, the unicorn, which could be captured only by leaving a virgin beneath a tree so that the animal, attracted by the odor of virginity, would go and lay its head in her lap. Monster didn't disappear with the medieval Mirabilia, but returned in the modern world, albeit in another form, as portenta. Portents were amazing and prodigious, but natural events, like the birth of an hermaphroditic, two-headed babies, strange animals. The attitude towards these creatures was no longer fright or an attempt to decipher their mystical significance, but it was an attitude of scientific curiosity, or at least pre-scientific curiosity. Lena Herzog, the wife of Werner Herzog, the movie maker, is now publishing beautiful a book in which she photographed all the fetuses in many Wunderkammer and museum, a real enormous anthology of atrocities that were in any case collected certain with a certain sadistic perversion, but also in order to know what happened in natural science. An important chapter in any history of ugliness was the physiognomy, a pseudoscience that associated facial features as the form of other organs with character and moral disposition. In his On Human Physiognomy, 1586, Giovan Battista della Porta compares the face of various animals with human faces, starting from the philosophical persuasions that the divine power manifests its regulating wisdom even in the physical features. Following the growth of these researches, from La Fata to Gall's phrenology, we arrive to the criminal anthropology of Cesare Lombroso, who, by studying the traits of the criminal personality, didn't simplify things to the point of saying that ugly people were always criminals, but he did associate physical stigmata with moral stigmata. The identification between ugliness and wickedness appears every time it was useful to represent the enemy, like the Pope on the part of the Protestants, the Saracen, the proletarian, but it reaches its peak in the racist representations of the features of the Jew. Let me only quote a passage from the infamous fascist journal La Difesa della Razza, entitled How to Recognize a Jew. What are the characteristics of a Jewish type? A strongly hooked nose, differing according to the individual, often with a prominent nasal septum and markedly flaring nostrils. Certain individuals from Southern and Eastern Europe have vulturine profiles so pronounced as to make one think of a selected type. Fleshy lips, the lower one often protuberant, sometimes very noticeable. Eyes not deep set in the sockets, with usually a gaze that is rather moister and clamorier than that of other types, and more hooded eyelids. Woolly hair, and regarding the body, slightly curved shoulders and flat feet, not to mention rapacious gesture and slouching gait. You see, in this propaganda of Repubblica Sociale of Salò, there was the Jew associated to the communist, but representing America and the Statue of Liberty and menacing the Aryan race. However, between the end of the 18th century and the flowering of Romanticism, we witnessed a sort of redemption of ugliness. It happens first with the aesthetics of the sublime, which imposed a radical change in the way people saw the ugly by analyzing our reaction to natural phenomena dominated by the formless, the painful, and the terrifying. Thus, we sense the sublime on seeing a storm, a rough sea, rugged cliffs, glaciers, abysses, boundless stretches of land, caves and waterfalls, when we can appreciate emptiness, darkness, solitude, silence, and the storm. All impression then can prove delightful when we feel horror for something that cannot possess us and cannot harm us. On the tragic art, Schiller observed that it is a general phenomenon of our nature that sad, terrible, even horrific things are irresistibly attractive to us, and that scenes of suffering and terror repel and attract us with equal power, and that we greedily devour ghost stories that make our head stand on end. It was that spirit that led, a few decades previously, to the Gothic novel with his ruined castles and monasteries, terrifying vaults, bloody crimes, diabolical apparitions, and decomposed bodies. Thus, among the protagonists of the romantic drama, we see the damned hero, like Byron's Chaur, and the various villains found in Sue, Balzac, Emily Bronte, Stevenson, down to our own day. But the most ardent romantic eulogy of ugliness came with Victor Hugo's preface to his play Cromwell. The ugliness that Hugo saw as a typical of the new aesthetics was the grotesque. a deformed, horrible, repellent thing transported with truth and poetry to the real of art. The most fecund and of the sources that nature makes available to artistic creation. As Raymond Baudet observed, Hugo makes beauty turn full circle, thus leading it to coincide with ugliness. See, for instance, the description of the hunchback of Notre Dame, Quasimodo. We shall not give the reader an idea of that tetrahedral nose, that horseshoe show mouth, that little left eye obstructed with a red bristling eyebrow, while the right eye disappeared entirely beneath an enormous wart, or those teeth in disarray, broken here and there like the battle parapet of a fortress, of that callous lip upon which one of these teeth encroached like the tusk of an elephant, of that forked chin, and above all of the expression spread over the whole, of that mixture of malice, amazement, and sadness. A huge head, bristling with red hair, between his shoulders an enormous hump, a counterpart perceptible in front, a system of thighs and legs so strangely astray that they could touch each other only at the knees, large feet, monstrous hands, and with all this deformity, an indescribable and redoubtable air of vigor, agility, and courage, strange exception to the eternal rule which wills that force as well as beauty shall be the result of harmony. Oh, let's see the description of Gwynplaine in L'Homme qui rit, The Man Who Laughs. Nature had been prodigal on her kindness to Gwynplaine. She had bestowed on him a mouth opening to his ears, ears holding over to his eyes, a shapeless nose to support the spectacle of the grimace maker, and the face that no one could look up without laughing. But was it nature? Had she not been assisted? To slit for eyes, a hiatus for a mouth, a snub protuberance with two holes for nostrils, a flattened face, all having for the result an appearance of laughter. It is certain that nature never produced such perfection single-handed. But is laughter a synonym of joy? Such a face could never have been created by chance. It must have resulted from intention. Had Gwynplaine, when a child, been so worthy of attention that his face had been subjected to transmutation? Why not? Industrious manipulators of children had worked upon his face. It seemed evident that the mysterious and probably occult science, which was to surgery what alchemy was to chemistry, has chiseled his flesh, evidently at a very tender age, and manufactured his countenance with premeditation. That science, clever with the knife, skilled in obtrusion and ligatures, had enlarged the mouth, cut away the lips, laid bare the gums, distended the ears, cut the cartilage, displaced the eyelids and the cheeks, enlarged the zygomatic muscle, pressed the scar and cicatritis to a level, turned back the skin over the lesion, whilst the face was thus stretched, from all which resulted that powerful and profound piece of sculpture, the mask, Gwynplaine. Thus, the search for the interesting of the grotesque also leads us to imagine the deformity that drags toward the tragic destiny who those who may be meek by nature but are condemned by their own bodies, like the first unhappy, ugly man of Romanticism, the monster in Frankenstein, or the heroes of Verdi's melodramas, like Rigoletto, or Cyrano de Bergerac, as well as the women condemned to an everlasting unhappiness by their unpleasant countenance. In a short story by Zola, Le Repoussoir, et Le Repoussoir est la racchia. How can it be translated in English? La racchiona. Well, a certain Durandot realized that on seeing two women walking together, and when one of them is visibly ugly, then by contrast, everyone finds the other one pretty. So he decides to make ugliness a business and sets up an agency where ladies can hire an ugly female partner to stroll along at their side and thus highlight their own good looks. Even though sometimes the client is even uglier than what her companion is offered to her, and then she discovers her own scarce attractiveness only in that moment. It is awful to read about the recruitment process and the way in which ugly women are told about the reason and the purpose of their being hired. But what is even worse is the suffering of the chosen candidates who, after enjoying a day spent dressed elegantly at the theater or an expensive restaurant in the company of a high society lady, must return to their lonely lodgings of evening, faced with a mirror that reminds them that atrocious truth. The same mirror that reminded the young Sartre of his own condition as an irremediably unattractive man and an ugly duckling beyond redemption. Decadentism was especially indulgent even with the most repugnant form of physical decomposition, and from the 19th century onwards, the corruption caused by a lung disease is sublimated not only by literature but also by painting, whether the artist makes idealized portrayals of the exhausted abandon of a beauty on the verge of death. Let me only quote a short passage from Barbé d'Aurevilly. "Yes, my Léa, you are beautiful. You are the most beautiful of creatures. I would not give up your defeated eyes, your pallor, your sick body. I wouldn't give them for the beauty of the angels in the heavens. That dying woman burned him like the most ardent of women." At the beginning of the 20th century, the futurists fought against moonlight, museums, and libraries, and set themselves the task of boldly producing ugliness. Palazzeschi, in Il Controdolore, called for the younger generation to receive an education in the disgusting. "We have to teach our children to laugh the most unrestrained, insolent laughter. We will supply them with educational toys, hump-baked, blind, gangrenous, crippled, consumptive, syphilitic puppets that mechanically cry, shout, complain, are afflicted with epilepsy, plague, cholera, hemorrhoids, the clap insanity, puppets that faint, emit a death rattle, and die. Their teacher will suffer from dropsy and elephantiasis, or be thin as a ray, long-limbed, with a peck like a giraffe. One tiny little teacher, a stunted hunchback, and another gigantic teacher with a prepubescent face and extremely feeble voice who weeps tears like shards of glass. We futurists want to cure the latent races, especially our own, of conscious pain, conformist syphilis, aggravated by the chronic romanticism, and of the monstrous susceptibility and piteous sentimentalism that depress every Italian, substituting the use of perfumes with the use of stench, transforming insane asylums into finishing schools for our new generation." Boccioni called both a sculpture and the painting anti-grazioso, anti-pretty. German expressionist portrayed with systematic and ruthless insistence haggard and repugnant faces that expressed the squalor, the corruption, the smug carnality of the bourgeois world that was to become the most docile supporter of the dictatorship. In the Dada movement, attraction of ugliness emerged to the appeal to the grotesque. A particular propensity for disturbing situations and monstrous images is evident in the Surrealist Manifesto of 1924, in films like Buñuel and Chien Andalou, 29, where we see repugnant operation like the vivisection of an eye. Bataille immortalized the big toe and flowers as objects of disgust. We might consider the big toe always more or less tainted and humiliating to be psychologically analogous to a man's brutal fall and therefore to death. The big toes horrendously corpse-like and at the same time overbearing and proud look corresponds to his derision and lends sharp expression to the disorder of the human body. Later, the informal movement was to reassess what had until then been seen as unrepresentable, in other words, the most inaccessible depths of matter, moles, dust, and mud. New realism rediscovered the detritus of the industrial world and fragments of destroyed objects. Exponents of pop art like Warhol appealed for an aesthetic recycle of waste. Piero Manzoni presents in a gallery and sold at a very high price his artista shit, merda d'artista. Today, we recognize as artistically beautiful those works that had horrified our fathers. The ugliness of the avant-garde has been accepted as a new model of beauty and has given rise to a new commercial circuit. Certainly, in contemporary art, the borderline between beautiful and ugly has been cancelled. Better, contemporary art doesn't seem still interested in producing beautiful objects, but rather forms of provocative behavior. But it has been said that the borderline has disappeared also in our everyday life. We today coexist with contrasting models because the opposition beautiful-ugly has no longer any aesthetic value. Ugly and beautiful would be two possible options to be experienced neutrally. Monsters can be ugly in many science fiction movies, and in the various nights of the living dead, but others are certainly lovable, like E.T., or the extraterrestrials of Star Wars, and fascinate not only children who are also won over by dinosaurs, Pokemon, and other deformed creatures. But also adults, we relax in front of splatter movies where brains are reduced to pulp and blood spurts onto the walls, or amuse themselves by reading horror stories. But the same person doesn't seem to have lost the traditional sense of beauty, since they still take aesthetic pleasure in a fine landscape, a handsome child, or a flat TV screen that shows the canon of the golden section. The same people today accept the idea of furnishing design teams, of hotel architecture, and of the entire tourist industry, which sells classical pleasing forms, like the Las Vegas versions of the Venetian Palazzi, ancient Roman dining room, or Moorish architecture. And at the same time, choose restaurants, hotels, and noble by 20th century avant-garde paintings, genuine or reproduction, that their grandparents would have considered the negation of the ideas of classical antiquity. The cinema, television, and magazine, advertising, and fashion all propose models of beauty that are not so different from the ancient ones. And we could easily imagine the faces of Richard Gere or Nicole Kidman portrayed by a Renaissance painter. But at the same time, young people who identify with these ideals, aesthetics of sexual, also go into raptures over rock singers whose features would have struck Renaissance men as repellent. And the same youngster often make themselves up, tattoo themselves, and pierce their flesh with pins so they look more like Marilyn Manson than Marilyn Monroe. See a comparison between a contemporary example of piercing and two faces painted by Hieronymus Bosch, also pierced by various kinds of rings. But Bosch wanted to portray the persecutor of Christ, and so he painted them as people of his day conceived of barbarian or pirates. And don't forget that as late as the 19th century, psychiatrists and saw tattoos as a sign of degeneracy. Today, piercing and tattoos are thought to be a generational challenge at most, but they are certainly not seen by the majority as a criminal choice. And the girl with a tongue stud or tattoo dragoon on her exposed belly can take part in a march for peace or for starving children in Africa. Neither the young nor the old seem to find this contradiction a dramatic one. The late 19th century aesthete who favored cadaverous beauty as a challenge or a rejection of the tastes of the majority, knew he was cultivating what Baudelaire called the flowers of evil. Such people chose the horrible precisely because they had the sight to make a choice that set them above the crowd of right, mean-minded people. Their problem was to épater les bourgeois. But young people today who flaunt an illustrated epidermis or spiky blue hair do so to feel similar to others, while their parents who go to the cinema to enjoy scenes previously visible only in anatomy theaters do so because così fan tutti. Another case in which come up against the dissolution of the opposition ugly beautiful is the cyborg philosophy. At first, the image of a human being whose various organs have been replaced with mechanical or electronic apparatus, the result of a symbiosis between man and machine, could still represent a science fiction nightmare. But with the advent of cyberpunk, the prophecy has come true. What's more, radical feminists like Donna Haraway are proposing to overcome gender difference through the creation of neuter, post-organic, or transhuman bodies. Does this mean that the clear distinction between beautiful and ugly has really disappeared? What, if on the contrary, those behaviors on the part of young people or artists were merely marginal phenomena practiced by a minority? And what if cyborg splatters and the living dead were superficial manifestations played up by the mass media through which we exercise a far more profound ugliness that assails and appalls us, something we would wish to ignore? In everyday life, we are surrounded by horrifying sights. We see images of children dying of hunger, reduced to skeletons with swollen bellies. We see countries where women are raped by invading troops and others where people are tortured, just as we are continually exposed to images from the not-too-distant past of other living skeletons doomed to the gas chambers. We see bodies torn apart by the explosion of a skyscraper or of an airplane in flight, and we live in the terror that tomorrow it may be our turn. We all know perfectly well that such things are ugly, not only in the moral but in the physical sense. And we know this because they arouse our disgust, fear, and repulsion, independently of the fact that they can also arouse our compassion, indignation, instinct of rebellion, and solidarity, even if we accept them with the fatalism of those who believe that life is none other than a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury. No knowledge of the relativity of aesthetic values can eliminate the fact that in such cases we unhesitantly recognize ugliness, and we cannot transform it into an object of pleasure. So we can understand why art in various centuries insistently portrayed ugliness. Marginal as the voice of art may be, it attempted to remind us that despite the optimism of certain metaphysicians, there is something implacably and sadly malignant about this world. My book concludes with a text that doesn't support any illustration by Italo Calvino, a short story that springs from the real experience, La giornata di uno scrutatore. The Cottolengo in Turin is a Catholic institution full of incurable ill people, persons who cannot even feed themselves without assistance. Many of them born as monsters, like many of those we have talked about here. Not legendary monsters, but monsters who live ignored alongside us. The main character of the story is an official with the polling station, which has been set up in this hospital, because the monsters are citizens too, and according to the law, they have the right to vote. Shocked by the sight of this subhumanity, the official realizes that very many of the patients do not realize what they are going to do, and that they will vote according to the will of their religious helpers. Belonging, as it does, to a leftist party, the protagonist would like to oppose what strikes him as a fraud. But in the end, against all his political convictions, he concludes that those who have the courage to devote their lives to those unfortunates have acquired the right to speak for them. I would like to conclude even my speech in the same vein. I have presented images that oblige us to recognize that ugliness can provoke either fear and disgust or amusement, making us to laugh at many human miseries. But after having witnessed how pleasant ugliness can be when it doesn't concern ourselves, I think it's wise to end with an appeal for compassion.